Hi, it's Dave. In this video, I'm going to share a chat I had with my good friend, Emmett Peppers. I've known Emmett for many years, and over the years, we've talked about Tesla and Bitcoin and investing in a multitude of different topics. In the past year, though, Emmett has seen his personal portfolio grow from roughly about $1 million to over $30 million. And in this conversation, I dive into Emmett's investing approach. And more specifically, we look at the exact trades that Emmett did to grow his portfolio in such a radical way. All right, here we have Emmett Peppers on my show, and I want to welcome
you. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I've been wanting to do this interview for quite a long time. I guess it's been a while, several months since you told me about some of the trades you've made this past year, and I wanted to find out more information, but I also wanted just to learn, and also share with my viewers kind of what's going on. I noticed that you're saying that you finally quit your job, and now you're able to kind of share more openly. And I want my viewers to know that you didn't ask to come on my show. I asked you, early on several months ago, and I was patiently waiting. So I'm excited about this whole episode. Actually, before we go into kind of the trades that you've done this year that maybe some people aren't going to believe per se, I kind of want to go back into, like, let's say 7 or 8 years ago. And I want to, so for people who don't know, Emma and I, we go way back. We met through the forum called Tesla Motors Club. It's a kind of a Tesla enthusiast club. And in that club, they have an investor section where a lot of kind of early Tesla shareholders got involved in discussing the stock back, in 2012, 2013, et cetera. And Emmett was an early kind of user in that forum. You went by the handle Tesla Opt, right? TSLA Opt. And that was because you were using options, right? At that time for some of your trades, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Yeah, go ahead.
I was using option. I was working for Interactive Brokers, which I worked at up until my last day was just October 30th, a couple days ago. And I had learned how to use options from that job to some degree. You can do some pretty fancy trades with options, of course. But I thought options were a good tool to get exceptional leverage on opportunities such as Tesla.
Got it. And so that was back in what, 2012 or 2013 or so?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I discovered Tesla in either late 2011 or 2012. There was a prototype Model S at a fancy shopping mall near me in Greenwich, Connecticut at the time. And me and a friend of mine from Interactive Brokers, actually, who was in IT, we went to go visit it together. And it was just love at first sight, seeing that car and that user interface and that screen. And I got a test ride in a Roadster then, and that just felt exhilarating. But I was really in love with the Model S interface, to be honest.
Oh, really, huh? Did you get a chance to test drive a Model S early on?
Not at that time. Not until after studying it more closely with my friend. We both studied it closely. We discovered the Tesla Motor Club's forum together, where I met you, and it was a nice camaraderie, that forum especially. But I had learned that if you put a deposit down, then you would sort of get the right to a test drive at an event near you. So I was eager to put a deposit down early and get that test drive. I think, when did the test drives come in? Was that 2012?
Yeah, right? I think late, toward the end of 2012 or so.
Yeah, that's when I got my test drive. And by that time, I'd already been buying options and leaps, long-term options in Tesla in my IRA account and such. And
got it.
But when I got the test drive, I think, as you might have experienced, you realize this is the real deal. Like, this is a serious step change in technology. And you just, that was conviction, that experience to really go more full throttle into investing in Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought back then it was like a special time because like options were long dated options, leaps were pretty cheap, for Tesla. They just, the market, the shorts had just suppressed, the stock price so much. It was some really appealing deals out there. I mean, back then I personally I wasn't that exposed to options. And so I was just kind of all stock. And I was reading more about options like on Tesla Motors Club, et cetera. And it wasn't until like May 8th when Tesla had their Q1 profit in 2013, and it just spiked from like it was in the 50s, and it just went up to 70, and then it continued to go up, you know, the next weeks into 70, 80, and it broke 100 up to almost 190. And it wasn't until May 8th where I'm like, oh man, I think this is gonna continue to go up. You know, it was like one of those feelings where like, oh my gosh, this stock has been so suppressed for so long that it's like, it's not worth $70. You know, it's worth a lot more, you know?
Yeah.
And that's when like I got into options, you know, just like actually right after the earnings call, like when Tesla was around 70. And I didn't know too much. I just like was like, I told my wife, because I was like busy like getting my account set up for options, like on that morning, the day after, I'm like, I don't care what you buy, just buy something, anything, and just liquidate our down payment that we had been saving for a house, you know, just stick it into options, and doesn't matter the expiration date, doesn't matter the strike date, right, just buy it. And she was like, yeah, she was panicking at first, but after a while she got used to it, you know. Those were some interesting times though. Were you surprised at kind of the violent move up? I mean, we're talking about 2013. For people who don't know, the stock was stuck between $30 and $40 for like the longest time, and at least going into 2013. And then Tesla reported their first Q1 GAAP profit in 2013, May 8th, and the stock just skyrocketed.
Skyrocketed.
Yeah, it went from 50 up to 100, 150, et cetera.
Yeah, it was in the 20s it would bounce between the 20s and 30s. Like when it finally broke 40, you just knew something was up, right? I remember buying options, and I think the first round of options I bought, I must have discovered in 2011, because the first round of leaps I bought expired worthless. They were like 40 strike options. Mm-hmm. And I just reinvested more of my IRA at the time into more options for 40 strike or 35 strike calls or whatever. And the strikes only went up to like 40 at the time, I think, maybe 45 or I don't even think 50. So when the stock busted to like 50 or 60, I realized, wow, I think it's going to take off soon. So I sold all my like in the money 40 calls, which are already like a 10Xer. Yeah. And I used that to buy like 75 strike calls that were shorter dated, you know. Mm-hmm. And that went up like 50 fold, you know, in the next few months. And so I made a lot of money when it got up to 150-ish, and I had to pay some enormous taxes that year. It was a big win for my IRA that went from, you know, a few thousand bucks to like, you know, 500 or between 500 and a million in a year. It was amazing, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And my personal account as well, but my IRA, it was tax-free. So it was nice to kind of use that as a measurement.
Yeah. I mean, there was just a lot of, you know, stories and people back in the day on the forums who, we just had the sense of how suppressed the stock was, and to see it skyrocket and people in options, it was pretty an amazing time, I'd say. I noticed after that time, Tesla was just kind of got stuck in a rut. You know, it was like, 2013 to last year, right? 2019, basically, we got Tesla in a range, and it's just pre-stock price, but between 200 and 400 or so for the longest time. And it seemed like it seemed like the stock was just suppressed and it was going to skyrocket, right? If they could just get Model 3 down, you know, and become profitable. Yeah. But other times it seemed kind of rocky with, you know, different tweets going out and different stuff. So how did you, you know, handle, you know, 5 years of this range bound, just volatility going up and down?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so when I think of stock price, I think of market cap mostly. And I saw it in the, I don't know, like 30 to 50 billion market cap range. You know, we used to be at a 2 to 4 billion market cap when we first discovered it, somewhere in that range. And I was like, this is going to go much higher, I think. And then it was like this 30 to 50 billion market cap, which was, I think, like the $200 to $400 stock or something like that. But I always thought it was like a multi-hundred billion dollar market cap company waiting, you know, I always wanted to be the first adopter and be the first one of the first ones to get the Model S, first one to get the Model X, first one to get the Model 3. You know, it was one of the earliest to get all the products, because I think, as you and I had talked over the years, it's really all about the product, right? Like if you have a superior product, as long as you can build it in some profitable way, you're going to win out. And it was, I think, what separates me from, you know, others who gave up along the way is there's a lot of misinformation about Tesla, a lot of disinformation about Tesla from, about competitors coming, and people easily got scared off and were like, all right, I'm going to take my profits and run, or they just wouldn't invest. They'd think, oh, Mercedes or whoever's coming out, Audi, e-tron's going to beat them, and they would just believe the articles. And but I think you and I especially, we dive into things, and we'd want to read about experiences of people who test drove those other cars, and you'd have to also realize when you're reading the experience, is it an auto magazine that's being paid through advertising from Audi, or is it like an actual genuine user that's, given an honest feedback opinion? So you have to kind of read between the lines a lot of times and to get a real impression, because we didn't have the opportunity to test drive a lot of these potential competitor cars. And as long as there was no formidable competition, my conviction stayed pretty strong that eventually, Tesla would be able to build enough, they'd be able to build as many cars as they could, and they would sell every single one they could, and in the long run would win. And so, it was a long 4, 5, 6 year bouncing around of the stock price, like you said, and it was painful at times. But I think the camaraderie of the forums, you and I had other friends that were gung-ho Tesla investors, and we would talk with each other, try to look for faults in our own reasoning. We'd search hard. I'd listen to bear, arguments, all those famous, Tesla bears. I'd listen to their podcasts and try to find truth. And as painful as it was, I'd try to find like, what's their logic? What's their reason? It would all boil down to like, the competition is coming. That's the only real argument they'd have that, in my opinion, could be legible. And that argument just didn't stand based on everything we've read and seen.
Yeah, I remember you sent me like texted me some like of some podcasts, I guess, by one of the Tesla shorts, and I was like, okay, I'll listen to it. It's an episode, but after like 15 or 20 minutes, it's just like, oh my gosh, what am I doing with my time? It's just like so hard to, ingest some of that stuff. It's just like, yeah, it's beyond. I'm curious though, regarding like kind of your early product adoption principles. Like, I remember you got a Model S early on. Like, when did you buy that Model S?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I got it in March in 2013. I was one of the first 100 or a few hundred deliveries in the Northeast. I was living in Connecticut at the time. There wasn't even a service center in Connecticut, or the closest service center was Queens, and I lived in Stamford, Connecticut, which, 50 miles away or something like that. And it was, I got the delivery and I was like, wow, this is amazing. I love this car. I looked forward to driving it any chance I could. And like 2 or 3 weeks into owning it, it just wouldn't start up suddenly. And I was like, what happened? Like, what happened to my car? I know I'm an early adopter, so I expected like bugs and stuff, right? So I call a Tesla service center, and they give me kind of the runaround. They're like, yeah, we'll have someone call you. They had some like ranger service that called me, and like, yeah, we're gonna come look at your car. And he came to look at my car, and he said, yeah, there's a part missing. I'm ordering the part. And they gave me a rental car. It was like an enterprise rental car, or like a Honda. It's nothing compared to a Tesla, right? But a week or 2 weeks go by. I'm calling, trying to get updates. I'm not really getting an update of when this part's coming in that I'm missing. So I'm getting worried. And I'm thinking, man, what do people do like at my company, Interact, the company I was working at, what do people do there when they have customer service issues they can't get through? They email the founder, right? They guess his email. And so I was like, all right, I'm gonna email Elon Musk. So I guessed Elon's email, right? And this is 2013, before he was uber famous like he is now. He was well known, but he wasn't like he is today, right? He had maybe 1 million Twitter followers, not 30. I don't know what it was, but anyway, I guessed his email address, sent an email, polite, like, hey, I'm having this trouble, blah, blah, blah. And literally, like 15 minutes later, or maybe 30 minutes later, I get a call from the head of the Queens service center. The guy calls me. He's like, yeah, I'm sorry to hear about your issues. We're going to send a tow truck up tonight to pick up your car and bring it back to the service center here. And we'll switch it out with a part in our car and our lot and get it back to you within a couple of days working. And I was like, oh, that worked. Awesome. And then like an hour later, I get an email from Elon Musk. Like, lo and behold, like the founder emails me, and it was just like an amazing experience. And we went back and forth on email for a little while about ideas and stuff. It was really cool. It was really an interesting experience. I saved the email, share with my grandkids one day when he's like the king of Mars or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or soon to be probably the richest, person on earth.
But that was like a moment where I was like, wow, this company is different. Like Elon runs the show for real there. And like that was also helped build my conviction. Like if this guy is that hands-on and like can make things happen, that's a good sign too. He cares.
What was your Model S? Was it a performance or
No,
no?
it was an S60.
Oh,
It was
okay.
just yeah, it was I almost went for the 40. They had the 40 kilowatt range then. It was like software limited or something. But I could barely afford the 60 kilowatt range. Like, at this time, I could barely afford the car. It was really just to help build my conviction in the stock. And I loved early technology. My wife, like, I had to, it was really tense to get that car, but I was able to secure her confidence to get
Did
the
you
car.
take out a loan or did you just pay cash?
I think we took out a loan for that first car. Yeah, we did have
Okay.
a loan, and we were paying it off.
Yeah, I remember I had a hard time, I knew I had to be close to the product, so I was like on Tesla Motors Club, like DMing all these product owners personally, asking their experience back in 2012, the first owners. And then like I remember I'm like, oh man, I can't buy a Model S right now because the stock price is just too low. It's just like I need to put my money, in the stock. And so I would go to these Model S meetups nearby. They're Model S owners, right? And I would go to them and bring my wife, and then the people would be like, why are you here? You don't even have Model S, I'm like, yeah, just kind of I have some stock, but I don't have a Model S. But it was just like this thing was, I knew I had to be close to the product, but it was just like I knew it was an opportunity cost, anything I put into the car would be less stock. And so I held off until probably early 2014, and that's when I finally got, Model S. And I just, yeah, it was interesting. And then I think later on you changed your Model S. Did you get a P85D or something?
So when I moved to California a few weeks before I moved, that was 2000 summer of 2015, I think. I sold that or traded it in, and I still owed a bunch from the loan, but I traded that in for a used P85D that had the autopilot software, the first generation autopilot too. And my sister and I drove it across country using the supercharger network, which was a lot of fun when I moved to California from Connecticut and met my wife and kids. They flew and we met them there. But it was a week-long amazing trip using the supercharger.
And then that was 2015. I remember we went to a Tesla event. It was the Gigafactory, I think, opening event. I think you drove, right, your P85 there, and then you drove it back. You had to use some superchargers. I remember that because I remember you drove your Tesla, but we saw some Tesla execs drive IC cars.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because,
Didn't
yeah.
we go to the Model X event first? So what, didn't we go to the Model X in 2000, end of 2015, or
Was
was that
that?
2016?
Yeah, I forget.
I think I met you at the Model X event the first
Yeah,
time.
we were
And but
hanging
then we
at the
went to the
Model X.
Gigafactory thing later in that next year or something. But yeah, I remember, yeah, the execs weren't even all driving Teslas for a while. It
I
was
was just like,
crazy.
I was like, oh man, Emmett is driving a Model S here, but some of these other execs are driving IC cars. It's because, there's so many super people waiting in superchargers, right? It's just faster with IC cars sometimes. And then you got a Model X, right? When did you get your Model X?
I mean, this was a real stretch financially. The Model X signature deposit I put
That's
down
right.
for, and really couldn't. I was really stretching, like borrowing from my personal, my brokerage account to pay for it and such. And I was doing better at my job too, so it was a little easier. But yeah, I got that. I was one of the first, I think, thousand or a few hundred Model X's. This was a signature, and I can't remember exactly when I got it. I think it was end of the year 2015, I want to say, and or January 2016, something like that. And yeah, there was a lot of bugs with that signature version, but it was amazing. Those falcon wing doors. I just had a third kid and three kids in car seats, and that bench in the middle was awesome with the Falcon Wing doors, so easy to put them in. And, I was testing out the functionality, and I was like, this is so well engineered. I'd watched that Model X, unveil event multiple times and been so psyched to get that delivery. Yeah,
I noticed throughout the years, like, just the money that you've put into, the early Tesla products, like, your Model S and the Model X, and that Model X signature was pricey, that's not a cheap car,
It was by far the most expensive car I've had. Like, I never use that acceleration, they give you that crazy, it's fun for like a novelty sometimes, but
Did you take out another loan for that, or did you pay cash?
Yeah, no, I think we leased, I think leasing was available. Okay. We either did a loan or leasing for that one. And it was an expensive lease, or it was like $1,500 a month or something, something more. I don't know, but it was fun. It was expensive. At times I thought, like, should I really be paying for this? But it was like building my conviction to hold on to Tesla and keep playing that leaps game with Tesla through that long stretch where I was trying to stay, convicted on this company being the future.
And yeah,
I realized it's just a slower product life cycle, cycle along the way, that, people get new phone, people compare it to Apple, people get new iPhones every, or new phones every 2 or 3 years, but you don't get a new car on average for 4 or 5 years. So I just realized it would take a little bit longer to play out.
Yeah. How would your investing experience with Tesla be different if you didn't purchase those cars, throughout the years? You also, you got the Model 3 early on, right? When did you get yours?
Yeah. I was like VIN 1951 on the Model 3. So I can't remember exactly when that was, but it was early on.
Or so.
There's a couple little bugs in it, but I know early on. And I also got the solar roof. I was the first.
That's right.
Paying. I think I was the first or second paying customer in the north, in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, to get the solar roof installation.
Like, that's right. And it wasn't. It wasn't cheap either. Especially early
I got
on.
The expensive version.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got the expensive version, and sure enough, I'm like, man, can I even afford this? And at times, it was like, man, can we send our kids to the school we want to go to, or should I pay for the solar? Just making decisions, We ended up doing all of it, but it was risky for a little while. Like you said, like you asked, if I didn't buy all those products and have those amazing product experiences personally, I'm not sure I would have stayed invested in Tesla like I did. I might have exited, earlier on, and or diversified more, at least. But being an owner of their products like that, you experience it and you realize, like, everyone's going to love, anyone who tries this is going to love. And then you see friends, you push it on friends, and friends get a Model S or a Model 3, and then they're loving it. And then their second car a year or two later is like another Model S or Model Y or 3 or whatever, so you see all that happen and you just realize, like, this business is going to really take off.
Yeah. I noticed, I think with Tesla, it's like, once you like know the product, right, you own it, you drive it, you compare it with other vehicles, then you start to like really understand that this isn't just marginally better than other vehicles. It's like a different paradigm, it's a completely different approach and value system and everything. And it goes pretty deep. And I think that's, at least for me, I think for others too, it helps to be able to discern the arguments from the shorts. You start to hear all these arguments and you start to realize, wow, they don't really know the product, like, they just discount it, right? They don't really take it seriously. And all of their arguments are based upon all these other kind of random things. It's not based on the product. And I think being a product owner early on, it was a huge advantage for a lot of, Tesla investors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like you said, the bears, most commonly, they don't own the product. And a lot of them never even test drove it, right? And that's just a tell right there that they don't really know what they're talking about. And a lot of them, they're just talking about a paper accounting thing. And I'm not an accounting specialist or anything, but I know how to reach, or I know how to find a specialist on these subjects, right? Specialists that I trust, right? So whether it's from Tesla Motors Club Forum, there's, like a username called the accountant that like knows stuff backwards and forwards. And, that's more recent, but there's always been users on that forum that are experts or accountants for their professional career. And they dive into the details and explain things. So you can kind of go into the weeds that way, in those niches of the investment research by reaching out, and in Twitter especially, you know, you find the specialists in each category and you learn who to trust on that stuff.
Yeah, I noticed, I think one of the things I'm enjoying about my channel is as it grows and gets more exposure, I'm able to invite certain people that I think have some special knowledge or really focused knowledge on an area. And so like, you know, I was reaching out to the accountant on TMC, and he's like, well, I'm not ready for a public interview, but, you know, we can chat privately. So I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Or like, there's this neural net expert on TMC named Jimmy D. And I'm like, hey, you know, do you want to come on my show and let's talk about neural nets? And he's like, yeah, sure. You know, why not? And so, you know, I got like 50 questions on Twitter to give to him on this interview. But it's cool because even though like on a forum like Tesla Motors Club, they can share at a certain level, if I bring them on here, I can really go deep and get all my questions answered. And then I can share it with other people. So then other people benefit too. And so it's like, it's kind of a cool thing where I can like pick out those who I think, you know, might have some insight on, you know, Tesla or another company, and then learn myself and share it with others. So yeah, it's, yeah, I totally know what you're talking about though. Yeah. Picking those.
Yeah. People. No, I love what you're doing here. I think I've watched every or listened to every one of your interviews. I usually listen when I'm walking or in the car, but I've listened to them all, and I think you do an excellent job. Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of fun. I'm curious also, you caught Bitcoin pretty early on too, right? I know throughout the years you've been a pretty strong proponent of it. When was kind of your first exposure to Bitcoin? How did you get into Bitcoin early on?
Yeah, so Bitcoin, I think I read some article about it in 2011. I think it was, 2011, must have been 2011. And it just caught my eye, like, this is interesting, this cryptocurrency thing, you know, and this how it's open source, and there's only going to be a certain amount, so it defines the scarcity. And I thought, you know, at the time, I didn't have a lot of, you know, I didn't have a lot, so I put like a couple $1,000, and I think the Bitcoin price was like $20 or $30 at the time, you know, and so I bought, you know, however many I could at the time for like $1,000, and that was a big investment for me at the time, you know. But it was fun and exciting, you know, and I started telling all my friends and family and my parents about it, and a couple of people bought into it, and they were like, yeah, that's cool. And, you know, my dad was skeptical, you know, for a while or whatever, but I just thought that it was unique and there was a need for it. And that if it caught on, if enough people bought it or got into it, if it gained like a critical mass, which it might've already had, I thought that it would just go up exponentially to become like a digital gold. Like I wasn't so sure of the digital transaction aspect of it, like the functionality. I didn't know. I saw like news reports, of people trying to use it once in a while and like Starbucks or, you know, some places in New York City that offered it for like news publicity or whatever. But I never did that myself. You know, I just bought it to buy and hold, like as a long-term investment. And then when Mt. Gox, I don't know if you remember that exchange, luckily before Mt. Gox went down, that was like the main exchange you bought and sold it on. I had taken half of my Bitcoin off and put it in cold storage, luckily like a few months before it went down or a month or two before it went down. But yeah, I lost half my Bitcoin when that thing went down. But I have the other half in cold storage, and just, you know, I keep it in the USB stick in a Faraday bag, you know, just in case, you know, there's some like crazy solar flare or EMP blast that protects it, you know, just doomsday prepper type thing. Yeah, exactly. I'm not a doomsday prepper, but you know, something like that happens and erases everyone else's cold storage and yours survives. And guess what? Yours is worth 100 times more all of a sudden.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. So it's a small amount of my net worth at this point. I mean, it's enough to be a hedge against, a hedge against politicians is what this guy I like, Naval Ravikant, who you and I have talked about over the years on Twitter. I think that's what he calls it, but I think that's a short way to put it, a hedge against politicians.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, with kind of your whole thing, I guess with Bitcoin, like over the years, like how, like, I'm curious, I guess more specifically with Bitcoin, like, it doesn't seem like you come from like a technical or a computer background, right? Like you don't really,
that's right.
Yeah. Like, and you lived in the East Coast mostly, right? Is that I'm curious, actually, I've never asked you this. Where did you go to college?
Oh, that's a good story. That's a good question. So, I actually went to three colleges. The first two I got kind of kicked out of. My priorities were not very good early on. And in Boston,
Okay.
Boston University and Northeastern didn't make it a full year at either one of them, and kicked out of for substance abuse type stuff, and then I kind of got my act together and ended up going to Fairfield University in Connecticut. It's a smaller regional school, but I just wanted to get through college at that point, and I majored in communications because I was like, that's an easy major. Just show up, and sometimes you have to get public presentations and you get A's, and that's what I did. And even though I'm afraid of public speaking like everyone, I just felt like I didn't have to read a whole lot of books or do a whole bunch of reports. And so I finished up at Fairfield University and graduated in 2001 or 2002.
So, what was your major? Oh,
Communications,
communications. Okay, got
But it
it.
actually taught me a lot because my strong suit has always been math and numbers,
Okay.
and I've always been so fascinated with the stock market.
Okay.
And I wanted to actually go into the stock market in 2001 or 2002 when I graduated, but it was sort of a recession. It was impossible to get a job, so it was hard to get a finance job right out of college.
Yeah, because I noticed with the early Bitcoin folks, a lot of them were really kind of computer kind of geeks or people really into technology. But I'm interesting, like, what, how did you kind of catch the novelty or the potential of Bitcoin when you didn't really have a computer, let's say, background?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just when I first read it, it sparked my curiosity. When you get curious, you have passion to learn about it, and something about it, like this whole Byzantine generals problem that it was solving, and I like math and I wanted to read about that, and I just thought, like, this is the future. Just something clicked in me, like, in the future I could see this being like a real thing. Like, why is physical gold the end all be all? Like, why can't there be a digital gold, And so I thought, the more I read about it, the more I was just really curious. And I'm sort of a risk taker, a gambler. I'm not, it's a funny story how I got my first $5,000 to put a deposit down on the Model S to is I bet on the New York Giants $100 their second Super Bowl run and just kept double downing until they won. It was $10,000 suddenly. And I was like, wow, I'm going to use half this now. Finally, I have some money to put down on a deposit because we didn't have extra cash to put $5,000 down on a deposit, So, I'm a risk taker always to some degree, and I like playing poker, and
Actually, I want to dive into that a bit later on in the conversation. This whole idea of kind of risk taking and, versus kind of less risk taking, and kind of the advantages and disadvantages of both. Like, I know a lot of people, they have a hard time, I think, putting together both. Like, you tend to side with one angle or the other, like a lot of long-term investors, they look down on traders, right? And options, et cetera. But I've learned throughout the years, by knowing people like you and others, that you can't really look down on like short-term trading because the potential is just so massive, And like, there are a lot of course, horror stories or, people who take risks beyond what they should, and they lose more than they should, and obviously, like, controlling your risks is a big issue or a big thing. But for those who I think have their head on and know how much to risk and know that it's going to be volatile, they're going to lose some, but they know that when they win, they can win huge and that will outweigh like, 10 bad trades, et cetera. Like, if you can, if the people who catch that and they, like some people have done very well, and I think I respect that, in some ways, because in some ways, like long-term investing is, it's a different time frame. It's a longer time frame. Let's say maybe I'm looking out, holding a stock for 10 or 20 years. But in a lot of ways, I kind of think some of the concepts are similar. You're taking an asset that you think is undervalued at the moment, and you think it's going to be valued higher. People are going to treat it as a higher value asset at a later date, but the time frame is different. Like, a long-term investor might be looking at 5 or 10 years, but a short-term person might be looking at, let's say, 3 months or 6 months or something shorter. And but the conviction and the strength of conviction might be different too. The long-term person might have a stronger conviction because it's the time frame is longer, but the short-term person might have a little bit lower conviction, but the conviction is similar in the sense that they think it's going to be valued differently, you know, radically different in a period of time. And I think that to me, like, brings together the short-term and the long-term together. But yeah, kind of, let's push that off to a little bit later, because I want to ask you about some of the trades that you've done this past year. I wanted to, you know, ask you about this first kind of trade you did this year, which was the QQQ. And I remember actually, and one of the reasons why I could, like, you know, we could talk about this freely is because this isn't something that I just found out after the fact, right? So, I mean, I remember you told me back in January, or December, I remember last year you saying, I'm thinking about setting up an LLC, you know, so to track my trades to make it more formal. And then I remember you texting me telling me that I think in January or so you put in $100,000 into your LLC. So you had your LLC $100,000, and then you had your personal account, and then you had your IRA, right? Those three accounts basically. And I remember back in January you're like, you know, gonna make some trades, etc. And so this whole thing, COVID hits, right? And so you short QQQ in at the end of January, is it?
I bought a bunch of puts in the NASDAQ ETF QQQ. Yeah, so short-term puts in the end of January in my personal account, not in the LLC yet.
Got it. So for those who aren't aware, QQQ is basically, it tracks the NASDAQ, you know, 100. It just, it's a way to, you know, track the market. So you buy puts on that at the end of January. What was your reasoning for that? And what were you expecting?
Yeah. I feel like I've gotten
more importantly, how much did you put down? Like how much of puts did you buy?
Yeah. The first trade, I think I bought just in my personal account, like 800 contracts.
Okay.
And this isn't the actual index puts, which is like a symbol NDX that's trades on the CBO exchange. This is, the ETF index. So it's 100, a normal option contract of 100 multiplier. And so 800, I guess, translates to 80,000 shares of QQQ or something like that you're shorting, or you have exposure to that at a certain strike price, you know, that whole option thing. So I bought that, but it was only 2 weeks of expiry at the end of January, just because I've gotten pretty good at, I think, sourcing information. Like, people have told me I'm very good at seeing things differently, maybe because I take in a ton of information from different sources. A lot of times sources I don't agree with, even I take in information to consider it, you know, and I'm skeptical of all the information I take in too, even from sources that I normally do agree with, right? Mm-hmm. So on Twitter, for example, I was just observing what was going on in Wuhan. And I just really thought, like, this looks serious. Like, this isn't just some, you know, social media ploy. Like, this might be the real thing. This might be a real, you know, bioweapon or escape or serious pandemic, you know? And so I was like, you know, when this comes around and in the US or Europe, like, there could be some serious panic in the market. And I was worried about, you know, my LLC's portfolio, my personal accounts portfolio, my IRAs, you know? So I realized I should buy some of these index puts to hedge myself. I've never really done that before, you know, but I know that's what you should do if you think something serious is going to happen. So the first time it was like 2 weeks out and it expired worthless, even though there was more fear building up. Right.
Yeah.
But by that time, it expired in early February or something like that, February 14th or so, I don't know, something like that. NASDAQ was even higher than when I bought the puts. Right.
So how much,
still going up.
Yeah. How much did you lose on that trade?
Oh, I think my personal account, I think I lost, couple hundred thousand, 200,000, something like that, you know, but I had gains I'd taken earlier already to offset it with. So the way I looked at it was like, well, I'm buying these puts half off because otherwise I'd be paying, you know, capital gains taxes or income taxes on some short-term gains that I luckily, you know, I realized earlier. So I was like, even if I lose these puts, they're going to go against some of my capital gains, cross off some of them. So it's not as, you know. So the second time I was like, I still think this is going to come and the stock's even higher, but you know, I can't time this in 2 weeks. Like that's just too risky. So I'm going to go 2 months out. So I think NASDAQ, the QQQs were like $235 or something like that. I forget. I don't know where the NASDAQ index was or what that corresponds to, but QQQ was around 235. And I bought the puts and I thought like, I think when this comes, I think there could seriously be a 20 to 30% drop in the market, like pretty quickly, you know, because it's gone up so much too. So I bought, I think 200 strike prices for the puts that were like 2 months out. They expired in like late April or something like that. And then sure enough, like a few weeks, the next week and the following weeks, it like started tanking the market. And I thought also like, this is like sort of lucky or I don't know, foresight or whatever. I thought my whole, you have to know when you're going to get out of your trade, right? You can't just buy a trade and expect it to, you know, you have to have a plan, right? My plan was when the fear index was the highest in the US, like when I thought like what I was seeing in Iran by that time and in Italy on social media, like citizen journalism, you know, I thought was serious and that's bad, you know? And when that type of scene comes up in some city in the United States and it's publicized in mass media in the United States, that's when I'm going to get out because that's going to be the worst, I thought, you know? And so sure enough, New York City gets hit hard, right? And it's sort of like that same kind of coverage is happening and everyone's thinking the world's ending, this is terrible. And I'm like, all right, I'm getting out now because I made 20X my return. The NASDAQ was at like 180 at that point. Wow. Okay. I'd bought the puts for like $1.20 or something. I sold them for like $25 or something like that. So I also had bought them in my LLC and my IRA account and my personal account that second time, which was good. So the first time I bought it just in the personal account because that was like the bulk of my assets. And the second time I bought it in all three accounts. So,
yeah. Got it. For those who don't know, when you buy a put, so the QQQ was at 235, you bought a 200 strike put for 2 months out. What that means is it gives you the right to sell your QQQ, I guess 100 shares per contract at a price of $200, right? And so when QQQ drops to 180, then you have a 200 strike price. You could sell it for $200, but the actual price is 180. So the price of the put is that $20 plus time value. So basically, yeah, I mean, that's a huge trade because to buy it for what, $1.30 or something, right?
$1.20, I think.
Yeah, something around there. $1.30. To see it go up 20 times in value within a month or so, right?
Basically. Yeah, a month. Okay. Yeah, and there's still like a month left to expire. I sold it in March sometime, I think.
And then you exit, you know, close to the bottom. Part of that, you know, is like, I guess you had your own framework, which is, you know, fear index at the highest. Part of that probably is kind of luck too, because like,
yeah,
it's hard to tell exactly. I mean, luckily the Fed came out, you know, just a few days after that saying we're going to do unlimited QE, you know, backstop the market at all costs, right? So that helped, you know. I'm curious though, yeah, like the total trade, like how much did you make out of that, like in your different accounts? Yeah.
I think I made like, I must have been, I think I made a little over in all three accounts, like 2.5, almost 3 million. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I used that cash like over the next month, like just to make sure the stock market wasn't going to keep going down. I wanted to make sure it's going to come back, you know, as it started to come back, I used that cash, you know, in my personal account, mainly to buy Tesla stock. Cause I was like, I'm just going to buy the stock. There's the options. I'm getting heart attacks with the options, you know, like this is time just to buy the stock. I bought a whole bunch of Tesla stock at like 420 before the split, when it was coming back from its like 350 or 380 low one day or whatever the next day. So I bought a bunch of stock around there. And I also sold some Tesla stock when it was like on the way down around 700 before that. So I did really well on that in the personal, but in the LLC account, I wanted to diversify a little bit more and employ my kind of strategy to other names and stuff. So I bought, I think you and I chatted about Square as an interesting option, for example. So I bought, Square Leaps. I think Square was trading at like $50 or 40 or 50 or something like, and I bought like 120 Strike Leaps, I think. And for like a couple dollars, you know, or something. $3 or $4, but for like 2 years out, you know, because I think the Leafs short term, like you said, it's risky. And as much as I like to take risks, I think the Leafs, the longer term options, is the best risk reward sometimes. It's better for my stomach, at least, you know, a lot of times. But so I bought Square Peloton, Leaps, or the Peloton didn't go out that far, but I bought 60 Strike, and now it's like 120. That was like $30 at the time trading. So that was good. You know, it's a couple others that haven't been quite as good yet, but I still think I have time to run more.
So then you stuck most of your money, I guess, into different, so Tesla stock, but also different calls of different companies. How did you, what happened after that? Like, did you just hold on to these companies?
Yeah, I've been holding on to them. I haven't done much. I've, you know, had a little extra cash in my LLC account to play around with. I tried to time when Nikola, you know, I've always known Nikola as a, you know, you and I both know it is, and anyone who's followed Tesla for a long time seriously knows it's sort of been a scam with that guy and such. Maybe he really believes what he's saying, but he's just crazy. I don't know. But the whole hydrogen fuel cell thing is just never going to really pan out too much. And so when Nikola went up in early or mid-June, I think it was after some SPAC deal or some deal, it went up to like 70 or 60 or $70 from like $15, you know. And I think it was right after the SPAC was announced or something, or some corporate action. I just thought, like, man, this is crazy. Like, how did this market cap triple like over the weekend, you know, and or over a couple of days? And I think it was like a Wednesday, and it was trading at like $69. I just thought there was a chance it was going to tank. The puts were so expensive, though. The shorting the stock was impossible, like to find a locate, and if you could, it was like very, very, very expensive. But the puts were even very expensive. But I just thought there was like a 20% chance or more that by the end of that week, within a few days, the stock would just crash back down to like $30, even though, you know. So I bought these 40, I think it was 48 strike puts, and the stock was at like $65 or $70. And yeah, the next 2 or 3 days, they were only like 2 or 3 days. It was like the most short-term trade I've done. But you know, you can't be afraid to take these types of chances, you know. And the stock went down to like I think $50 or $54 or something at one point, but then it went back up, and so that turned out to be a worthless trade. But it was like $20,000 or $30,000 of my LLC account, which was a small percentage of my LLC account at the time. But yeah, so you know, I took a risk there too, and it doesn't always pay off.
And then in your personal account, you ended up buying Leaps, right, with Tesla as well.
Yeah, so on my personal account and the LLC account, I bought a bunch of Leaps in January, and I've had Leaps in my personal account since last year or a couple of years ago. I've had Leaps in my personal account all along. I just keep rotating them every couple of years, as cost effectively as I can, as they, you know.
Like for those who don't know, Leaps are long dated option calls. So they're a contract where you can buy stock at a certain price, but down the road, and so you pay for that ability or that contract to buy like stock at a certain price. I remember back in the day, this was like, man, like 2014 or something. I remember I wrote on Tesla Motors Club kind of a strategy to kind of use stock and Leaps, you know, together. And when you think the stock price is high, you just transfer all your, you know, Tesla to stocks. But when you think the stock price is really low, right, it's in a lull, then you kind of transfer it to Leaps. And so you kind of, you know, take advantage of, right, the leverage. But the problem with that strategy is if the lull is like too long, right, then you get smashed because you're waiting, waiting, waiting for this like thing to go up. But it, let's say you run out of cash, or you give up, let's say, you know, right before it starts to go up because like it's just been too long. I mean, what's been your experience kind of, you know, holding on to, let's say, you know, Leaps, these option calls, and, you know, like, let's say in the case of Tesla, it's just, you know, wasn't, you know, going up for the longest time, and your account is bleeding money. Like, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I sort of employed that strategy myself. I thought the same way. And I don't know what year, 2016, 17, I transferred a lot of the stock I had exercised from the earlier gains in 2014 or 13 and 14 into leaps in my IRA account, especially where there's no tax consequences when you do that. And my IRA account went from, I don't know, like 500,000 to, like, a year ago, I think it was like 70 something thousand. So it dropped substantially. I still had a bunch of leaps. They were like 450 strike leaps for January 2021. But a year ago, those were trading very cheap, compared to now. And those 450 strikes after the split are now what, $90 or something like that. So back then, like you said, it's painful. And but because I spent so much time, I spent, thousands and thousands of hours like researching Tesla to like keep my conviction going, and try to look for faults in it, in my belief. And I couldn't find the faults. And, I just felt also because of 2013, 2014, where I had that big windfall, that it was sort of like house money, psychologically to speak, I guess. Gamblers, they talk about house money. Like, if you win a bunch of money, you can keep gambling with that money. And it's just money you won from the casino house anyway. So what, you kind of emotionally detach from it in a way. And so part of my thinking was a little bit of that, but also I had a job that was stable and paid me well, and I could survive on my retirement plan with that company that was separate. So it was almost like completely compartmentalized or segregated from my, main personal, living. So those two things, I think, helped me stick with it. And the fact that I just, studied it like you do, probably not as much as you, or maybe as much as you, I don't know. But I would read those Tesla Motor Clubs forums all the time. At night, I'm on it. My wife's like, "What are you doing?" I'm reading these motor club. You skim through it and you read Twitter, look for it, or you read all the analysts you can, and you just know that the stock, that the company is going to be very successful, and it's just a matter of time before the stock would catch up.
Yeah, like I know some other folks too that really just believed that Tesla was just like undervalued and suppressed, and they just kept on holding on, buying leaps, but just getting really destroyed, especially like because the expectation was like, hey, 2018, we're gonna see a huge spike in the stock price as Tesla gets profitable and everyone finds out. But then 2018 becomes this like long, like, disaster or, drama story. And then 2019, it's not looking, that great, at least the first half. And yeah, I have a friend who just like got demolished, because he was just holding on to leaps. And like, for when I look at that, I'm like, I mean, it's really like really demolished. Like, like we're talking like, losing 90, 95, 95%, let's say, of your portfolio value or something.
Ouch.
Yeah, to the point where it's like you don't even have that much left, And
Yeah. Oh, painful.
it's painful. And then like for when I look at that, I'm like, wow, man, that's just painful. And I think most people would just give up. It's like, hey, that's it. I'm out of investing. Fold the towel, it's over. But like this guy, he just like he kept at it, and he saw, I think, I don't know if the numbers are exactly correct, but he went from basically like a million in his portfolio down to like 50,000, right, through this whole time. And he's still holding on to leaps, like rolling them out, right, basically. And I'm like, wow, I'm not giving feedback because I'm like, wow, you lost a lot, and you're still like doubling down. And then he just it's like winning the lottery, right? Because Tesla stock goes up, and for some reason the guy doesn't sell, just like he's convinced that this is just the beginning, right? And so he holds his leaps, until Tesla's like 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, and whatever. And then he emails me, as Tesla is over 2,000, he's like, hey, I've made, several $1 million or something, my retirement is now set, and like, I'm glad I held on, et cetera, right? And it's like, wow, it's like these type of stories, like, I don't know if I would completely believe it if I wasn't like, I didn't know these people personally. Like, I actually know them pretty well. Like, I've seen them over the years, many, you know, corresponded, okay, met them in person, et cetera. I've seen the ups and downs. So it becomes real. It's like a real life thing, you know? It's like, wow, you go from 1 million to 50,000 back, you know, you go to 3 to 4 million or 5 million, I think, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's the power of like, it's not just the power of like options, but it's combined with these radical volatile moves, you know, in the market, especially with certain growth stocks following a long period of suppression, right? Of stock price suppression. And so it's like, I'm wondering in your case, because in some ways that is, I wouldn't say pathological, but there is an element of like, it's like, is this guy thinking, you know, sanely? You see your IRA drop from 500,000 to like 70 something thousand dollars. And most people would be like, throw in the towel, I'm done, you know? But for you, you have a different perspective, right? And again, you're saying you had a nice job, high income, high savings, you know, retirement, et cetera. So that cushioned a lot of it as well. But you know, to have that big of a loss, and also your personal account had a bigger loss, right? I'm guessing, right?
Big loss,
From that period.
Absolutely.
And so when you're down, let's say, I think a year ago, what your IRA from a year back from now, it was what, you said 77 or something, right? And then your your personal account was what? It's like
I think it was like 500 or somewhere between 500 and a million, or something like that. Okay. Which was a lot higher than it was before the 2013, you know, my IRA and my personal account before that 2013, 2014 windfall was like, they were both like $10,000.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So they both went up a lot, but, my personal account now, it had gone, it was as high as like 3 million at one point, and then it went down to like 1 million,
1 million
or less.
Yeah.
I think it was 500,000 by a year ago. Yeah. Maybe even that low. Yeah.
Okay.
So I lost a lot.
Yeah. So you see this, you know, dramatic. So you've gone through a lot of ups and downs, right? You know, ups and downs. Is there something you think about your personality where you're just a little different, like psychologically at all, or just like your view of money?
Absolutely.
Like, is it just with your relationship with money, or do you see something a little bit differently as well? Just like in general, you know, are you just a little bit different in how you view things?
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of people say, I just see things differently. I see opportunities a lot of times that other people might not see, or, you know, if I see, you know, something happen in the news or whatever, I might have a different take on it than most people. People might say like, that's weird. Why would you think of it that way? And then I'll say, oh, how do you think of it? And then it would be kind of weird to me to think how normal people think of something, you know, and I'd just have to adjust, or I'd have both ways of looking at it, you know? So there's certain things I see, you know, that I think maybe I have conviction in myself, enough confidence in myself, you know, like me, you and I have talked about like diet, nutrition in the past, for example. Right. And so, for example, I think, you know, we talk about coronavirus. I think we're in the worst epidemic of our times in terms of obesity, and no one talks about it. You know, nutrition is terrible in modern society, you know, and tons of people die. We don't even talk about it. You know, it's like just accepted. And so I see a big picture there. Like, how come no one, you know, so I just see certain things that I see the world differently, I guess, you know, in a lot of ways, and it helps me and it hurts me in certain ways. Maybe, but I think it helps me in investment opportunities potentially.
Got it. I asked you earlier today to send me some portfolio, what your portfolio is right now, right, in your personal IRA and LLC, and you sent me some screenshots. And from your personal, you're at 22 million. So we're recording this right now, Sunday night, November 1st, right? So
after a really harsh day on Friday, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that was a painful day. Yeah. So 22 million in your personal account, 5.2 million in your IRA, and 5.7 million in your LLC. So
that's right.
Yeah. So we've got about what, 33 million right now in those three accounts. And then I remember you're saying you pulled, what you said you pulled
three million out of the IRA. to invest in a SpaceX fund. Yeah, I did
Got
that
it.
earlier this summer
Okay.
at a 38 billion valuation. It was pretty
Okay.
lucky. I had that opportunity to do that, and I was jumped on it as soon as a friend, you know, guy I know works at a company called Shares Post, and
Yeah.
he came across. It's like, I'm doing it, and I spent like the whole week just making sure I got all the paperwork done to do it, because I was like, this is once in a lifetime, got to do it.
Got it.
So yeah, I did that in my IRA account actually, which is nice. So there's no like tax
Oh,
issues to
that's
worry
good. Yeah,
about,
yeah.
you know.
Okay. And then you also pulled some money for a house, right?
Yeah, so I pulled money from my personal account. You know, my life's changed in the last
Yeah.
year dramatically because of this, and so I'm working from home with the COVID, and I have a small, you know, 1800, 2000 square foot house with three
Yeah.
kids and a wife, and so we got a bigger house that has
Yeah.
a home office, and so I pulled money to buy that house, and we're renovating it right now before we move
Yeah.
into it. And got a house for my mom and mother-in-law to kind of live in together and share, which is not, you know, so
Yeah.
like what do people do in the NBA when they get a big contract? They buy a house for their mom, you know? So that's
Yeah.
kind of what I felt like
Yeah.
was good to do, because they both live far away, but they can kind of stay with us,
Yeah.
you know, if they want,
Yeah.
but not in our house, but at a house nearby.
Yeah, so the 33 million is not including, right, the 3 million you pulled to put into SpaceX plus money for a house. So we're looking at, you know, probably something closer, what, high 30 millions, right?
Yeah.
Compared to a year ago, right? I asked you to send me like a year ago, I guess actually I have the figures here. So a year ago, your personal account
Yeah.
was around 1 million, it seems
Yeah.
like, what I wrote down. And then
Yeah.
your IRA was 76,000. That's what I wrote down. So you're, and that was pretty much all your assets, right? I mean, you
Pretty
had your
much. I mean, I
house
had a
though,
few
right?
hundred thousand with a 401k
Okay.
and a stock plan. But yeah, altogether, you know, if you go a year and a half when the Tesla
Yeah.
stock was $180, it was like,
Probably
yeah, a lot
lower.
less
Yeah,
even.
that's
Yeah.
true. So let's say you go from 1 million about a year ago, and then you go up, you see your, you know, net asset worth go up to 30 to $40 million, right, in a course
Yeah.
of less than a year. Like, how do you process that? Like, what's going through your head?
It's hard to process. It's wild. I mean, especially in the year of Corona, like, you
Yeah.
know, it's when you're in lockdowns and going crazy with kids at home, young kids, trying to keep them busy and juggle all the stresses of everything. You know, a year ago, if you asked me, like, hey, Emmett, what do you want to do? What's your dream to do? I would have said, oh, I want to start a hedge fund to make a lot of money. You know, I think I have a good, that would be my purpose, incentive to just be a, start a successful hedge fund, you know. And then all this happened and I made a ton of money and I was like, well, the world's different to me now. You know, I have enough money. I'm not really interested in just making more money to start a hedge fund. You know, that's not really something I want to do. And I kind of thought about and prayed about it a lot. At some point I realized, you know, if I do have some special ability to have these like amazing investment opportunities to realize, you know, if I have some God-given ability that others don't, instead of just using it selfishly to build up my own personal accounts, I should start a hedge fund, but do it for something good, you know? And so that's when I started preparing for this next phase of my career, where I left my current job, which was very good and I really liked it and I was treated very well. But I just felt like, you know, once your net worth is a certain amount, you shouldn't be working for someone else. You know, you need to do something a little different, you know? And so this hedge fund that I'm doing now is more of a charitable thing, where there's half the fees are is being written into the prospectus that'll go to charity. So that's hopefully, if it does really well, the dream would be others follow suit and it starts a whole new breed of investment managers that, you know, write into their prospectus that a certain percentage automatically goes to charity.
Got it. I'm curious, like, seeing your, you know, net assets go from 1 million, I guess you had your house too, right? You had it and you put a down payment. So it's probably more than 1 million of net assets before that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the house, we had a big mortgage on it.
Yeah.
We still haven't, we didn't pay off the mortgage on this house, but when we bought the new house, we just paid it all off.
Okay.
We just paid cash for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this current house we're in now, we never paid it off.
Yeah.
We'll just sell it.
So did you, I'm curious, as you know, your net worth increase or net asset worth, I personally don't like the terminology net worth personally, just because, like,
yeah.
I have a strong belief that, you know, material possessions don't really connotate or signify worth, you know, in any real manner, you know? So
Yeah.
I like to just compartmentalize it, saying, your assets, asset worth or net asset worth. So you see it, you know, go from 1 million to 30, 40 million. Are you putting aside some of those of that for so-called, let's say, safer assets, or let's say income, let's say passive income, mm-hmm. or something to, you know, in case something happens, you know, where, you know, I don't know. Yeah. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's something I've been struggling with. I mean, I have taken so much, I have so much capital gain. Like, my first order of business is figure out how to most efficiently deal with my capital gains this year. You know, I have like something like 7 million of capital gains this year to figure out what to do with from the trades I did earlier with the Qs, and then selling Tesla on the way down, buying more, you know. So that's a huge tax bill I got to worry about. And that's really my priority in a lot of ways on the personal finance front. But at the same time, like you said, I need to find a better safety net in case Tesla does go to zero, right? But at the same, then I think, well, I am confident that if that happened, you know, I could find another job if I had to. Absolutely. It's not the end of the world. You know, like, yeah. I'm not going to, I've realized that money does not equal happiness. You know, I have money and it's great. It can solve a lot of issues. But I know I have the capability to earn a salary if I need to, that is comfortable enough if worse comes to worse. So I'm putting that up. My dream is to kind of hold the Tesla stock as much as possible and sell deep out of the money covered calls, you know, for income. And if some of those calls ever get exercised at some point, then I cash out at a good price for some portion of my Tesla stock, you know. But that's sort of my plan. But anything can happen. The stock market could get cut in half in the next week if some crazy election shenanigans go on, for example. I don't know. Who knows? Yeah. We don't know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like, I've kind of had this, you know, investment approach where, you know, I set aside, I have a kind of compartmentalized approach where I have some assets in real estate that are income producing, and that can cover kind of our living expenses, etc. And then the rest of my assets are more to kind of higher risk or higher reward, you know, investing, where I'm going after kind of the big opportunities. And so because I have kind of more of a safety net of certain assets, it allows me to take bigger risks with my other portfolio, or with my main, you know, asset portfolio. And I think
smart.
Yeah. So in some ways like, I've always had this thought where I don't think most of the investment field is capitalizing on that true essence of investing, like on really investing in the big winners, like these huge, like, decade winners, generational winners, like these clear breakouts, you know. I feel like a lot of the investment field is kind of like tainted with a lot of fear and preservation of assets. And I completely understand that. But I think it, when you start to mix both, you have like different needs. You have one need where you do need some safety and security and retirement, et cetera, take care of your family. But you mix that together with this need to grow your assets, and you put them together, then you get this weird thing of like diversifying across these weird asset classes, and you cut all of the potential gains, and it just becomes this weird, like, fear driven approach, you know? And so personally, like, I kind of have this thing where, you know, if I'm going to really, you know, latch on to what I think is the true essence of investing and really these outsized crazy gains, it kind of helps me to mentally think, okay, I've got this other set of assets that are income producing that are not really correlated, and that, you know, who cares if my portfolio does go to zero? At least, you know, I mean, even if I didn't have this other basket of assets of income producing real estate, I have a similar attitude to you. Well, I'm okay. I could go to work, find something to do, you know. I'm not very particular in like needing to live in a big house or fat house, you know. I'm actually happy with living in our RV, you know?
Yeah.
Except for when it gets kind of cold in the wintertime. But other than that, you know, just hanging out at the beach or something. It's like, I guess I would be like, you know, more leaning to that whole real estate as a potential for income. But the problem with real estate, I'm finding out more and more over time, is it kind of requires management, because, I mean, we have our, you know, one of our main properties has, like, you know, property management, et cetera, but it's like there's always things that prop up, you know? It's like, and it's unexpected things that we just have to get involved with. And it's like, yeah, it's just like, for example, this last week, you know, we got hit with a lawsuit, And I'm like, oh my gosh. And it's like, why or what, you know? And it's like not even our responsibility. It's like a tenant who runs, like, it's part commercial. They run a store, and they got hit with the ADA lawsuit, which is basically a handicapped person comes in and they find it's not up to code, and they sue the store, right? And oh, we nice. Have like nothing to do with it, right? It's like the tenant's responsibility, but then yeah. the lawsuit is put to the owners or something, right? And I'm like, geez, now we have to be calling up lawyers and trying to defend this suit, but it's not even our responsibility, and like having to get yeah. an inspector out and all this stuff. And so it's like, there is some downside, I think, to, you know, in terms of, and Warren Buffett talks about this a lot, you know, real estate is really interesting, except it's got this like overhead cost, this maintenance management cost, right, built into it. I haven't really looked into like, you know, other forms of more passive, let's say, I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, obviously more passive, you know, investment options like REITs or, you know, various, yeah. you know, dividend, you know, plays, et cetera. But I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like kind of, I mean, I know you bought your house full cash.
Yeah, the new house.
So that's in a way.
Won't move to yet.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's in a way diversifying, right?
You know, that is. I can always take out a home equity line of credit or something on that.
Yeah. So, you know, that's likely not going to go to zero. And then you diversify by taking, what, $3 million into SpaceX. So that's another diversification play.
Yeah.
It's somewhat, though, correlated, because if Elon Musk, you know, somehow, you know, dies, disappears, et cetera, you know, that is Tesla and SpaceX Starlink is all, you know, correlated.
Yeah.
So you're highly though, you know, I guess, dependent on, you know, Tesla or Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk is,
What I was thinking about, I mean, the thing, I hate taxes, you know, there's only two things for sure in life, death and taxes. Right. And I hate taxes. And that's part of the draw of the leaps of the long-term options, because they're always more than a year out of expiry. And so I like to hold them for at least a year. So if you do sell it for a huge gain, then it's long-term gains instead of short-term gains taxes, right? So especially in California now, the taxes are absurd with the, you know, at the highest rate and so forth. So, I mean, one thing I was considering is the IRA account has done so well. Maybe I should just sell that and put it into something really conservative and keep that cash in something conservative as like a real emergency buffer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously you don't want to take money out of your IRA before you're 60, because there's an extra like 10% penalty, right? Mm-hmm. But if worse comes to worse, you know, X million dollars with an extra 10% penalty can still help me out a great deal if Tesla went to zero, you know? But at least if I do that, I don't have to pay taxes to diversify right now, right? That's what I'm really worried about, is like, all right, I already have this huge tax bill for this year. Do I want to create a lot more of a tax bill for myself this year to pay the government the maximum? You know, I'm trying to figure out, I'm donating to a foundation. I'm considering conservation easement partnerships as a possible way to reduce taxes. You know, there's all these things I'm considering, and it's just kind of a headache, because I don't want to pay the maximum amount of taxes, because no one with the amount of money I've made, I feel like I'm the only one with this amount of money that would be paying the maximum. Anyone who's got this has all kinds of options to reduce their taxes, and I haven't figured that out yet, you know? So that's what I'm most concerned about in a weird way, is like, how do we be more efficient with not paying the maximum amount of taxes just to diversify, you know? And so what I've thought about is maybe just the IRA account, getting out of all my Tesla exposure there and putting it in something much more just cash even.
Yeah.
Or just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been, you know, like thinking about like the whole thing with like SpaceX, you know, like I'm doing this series on Starlink. And so like last week,
I'm excited for that.
Yeah. I put together this whole like research presentation, and this week, actually tomorrow, I'm releasing it. So it's like a 45 minute video on Starlink with like 70 something slides. And as I get into it more, I'm just like, wow, Starlink is just a crazy company. I mean, this thing is like, it just has so many things going for it, you know?
Yeah.
And
anything anything Elon does, you just know it's going to become gold pretty much. It's like, he's done this time and again, you know.
Well,
there's that, it's just like, why do people doubt his ideas or his company still? Like, it's crazy. Like, any of them are going to be, you know, sure, he might fail one or two, but the majority of them are wildly, wildly successful.
True. You know? Yeah. I mean, Elon isn't fail proof. You know, there are times where, you know, he makes his mistakes. I mean, like, I think the more he's involved, though, the better. Like, for example, Solar City, he wasn't that involved. And
that's
I think
right.
because of that, Solar City didn't have like this awesome, amazing, superior product, you know?
Yeah.
And they were kind of vulnerable, et cetera. But yeah, I think what kind of, you know, my line of thinking is like, you know, it's like, man, Starlink and SpaceX is actually like an amazing, I think, opportunity. You know, I was actually, when you were investing in SpaceX, I was super tempted to get into it as well.
Yeah,
at the time.
I tried to get you into it.
Yeah.
You were like, it had to be really fast.
Yeah.
I understand. Because I was like, I got to know by tomorrow, you know, and yeah. you were like, I don't know. And
yeah.
If I was in your shoes, I probably would have hesitated and not done it too.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think for me, it's like, I have to look at a few things. One is, okay, it's not a true diversification play because it's still like Elon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And number two, it's like, I'm going to have to pay taxes on my Tesla holdings, you know?
And yeah.
It's like, it's not just federal taxes, it's state taxes as well.
Yeah.
And so I have to calculate all that. And so it's like, you know, that's like, that's a lot, you know? It's like
yeah.
over a third of whatever.
Yeah.
So
that's why I did it. I was lucky enough to get it done in my IRA.
Yeah, I mean, that
like,
makes more sense. Exactly, yeah. yeah. But for me to like liquidate some Tesla or a chunk of Tesla, you know, give, you know, 35% or more, right, so let's say, to the government and then
yeah.
take the rest, invest in SpaceX.
I mean,
that could make sense, but it's kind of like, yeah, it's not a clear-cut thing because I still mm-hmm. see, you know, Tesla is having an amazing like road ahead, you know, for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
I'd love to obviously pick up SpaceX. I do have some money set aside right now, actually, to get into SpaceX, I think. So when the opportunity comes, I think I will.
Yeah, no, yeah. I think it'll come again. I mean, there's these SpaceX funds that, mm-hmm. you know, they have people trying to get out from time to time, I guess.
Yeah.
And you have to act quick. Apparently, you know, my friend works for the Shares Post companies. Mm-hmm. He says it's like the hottest pre-IPO thing
yeah.
they have, and when an opportunity comes, you got to jump on it.
Or, yeah, you know. Yeah. There's Shares Post. I was also looking into Forge Global. They're another big kind of secondary.
Yeah, there's a few of them.
Yeah,
there's a few companies that do this. Yeah,
yeah. So I want to actually ask you about like I remember we had like a text conversation back in December or so of last year, and your whole thing was like, what if or what price would you cash out, let's say,
yeah,
your Tesla shares?
And
your and your whole thing was like, you know, a Tesla this year could just, you know, next year it could go, you know, just skyrocket, you know, 1,000. This was when Tesla was under $400, right? Pre-split
yeah.
price. And so you were like, hey, Tesla can go, you know, $1,000, $2,000 or whatever. It's like, what's your price where you will, you know, sell your shares.
I tried to push you on that.
Exactly,
like,
right? I'm like,
tell me a number, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, oh, I don't know. You know, what are you talking about, right? And I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I've got, I don't want to pay taxes and I believe in this company long term. But you're like, you're insistent on saying, Dave, what's the price, right? Is it 1,000, you know, 1,500, 2,000, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, 1,000, no way. I don't think I'll do 2,000. 1,500, I don't know. And then like 2,000, I'm like, huh, that sounds interesting, right? But it all depend, like, I guess, at that time, like, on
yeah.
different things, right? You know, on, yeah, what I see in the future, et cetera, and the potential for Tesla. But I'm curious, like, for you back then to see Tesla, like it's $300-something pre-split. And what is going through your mind at that time where you're like, whoa, man, this thing could just, you know, go crazy. Because like I actually had a similar feeling too, because I'm like, this thing is like ready to pop, you know, especially with
yeah.
Model Y ramping, profit ramping, et cetera. So I'm like,
yeah.
you know, this thing could go, you know, over 1,000, you know, in this next
yeah.
year. And 1,000 was like a lot, you know, because it was like
yeah.
300. It's like this thing could triple.
Yeah.
But for you, you were thinking much bigger. You were thinking, you know,
yeah.
15 or 2,000 or more. What
yeah.
kind of got into your brain where you're like, whoa, man, this $300 stock could like, you know, do a 6 or 7 times in the next year?
Yeah, great question. I mean, to be honest, I feel like I've had that itch every year, like, hey, this thing's going to go up. But the itch was getting stronger and stronger. And then and last year it was really strong. And I was like, you know, I really think this is going to go up this year. Finally, it's been 5 or 6 years. So I was pushing you on it. I, you know, I started talking to people. It was like, this is the year, like the Model 3 is being produced, Model Y is, mm-hmm. you know, coming out. And, you know, and I just thought like by the end of this year with the volumes they're doing that they'd be profitable, the, Chinese factory is going to be producing, you know, full throttle. And I was just, it just didn't, to me, all the dominoes were lined up just to be like, wow, shorts are going to get out. They're going to realize like this is a game of musical chairs for them. And, you know, lots of more people are going to want to buy. And I also have this interesting theory that I feel like there's got to be some way to test it. Like maybe me and you can like one day come up with some way to like test this. But I feel like the more deliveries there are, right? Just like when more people bought the Apple iPhone, then more people were buying the Apple stock, right? And so the more deliveries there are of Teslas, the more retail people, and some of these retail people might be portfolio managers for a big fund or something, you know, who knows? And they're suddenly like, wow, I should buy some Tesla stock. You know what I mean? And so I just thought like this wave or this tide of Tesla was getting more and more likely, and that itch was really strong. And I was like, I'm going to set up this LLC. I'm going to start buying Leaps at the start of this January 2nd, as soon as I fund the account. And, you know, I'm going to save like 40% in cash in case Tesla dips, then I'll buy more Leaps at a lower price. But instead I bought the, you know, index puts at the right time and got, you know, so a lot of opportune mystic things happened for me this year. I'm never going to have the type of return I had this year again. I know that. I'll regress to the mean, but I still think my mean over the long term is going to beat the market, you know, by a long shot. But yeah, like it just felt like it was overdue. You know, it felt like 2013 all over again, 2012 all over again to me. Didn't it kind of feel like that to you, like leading up to this year?
Definitely. It was like one of those things where, you know, you had this 5 or 6 year just lull and suppression, right? And also media onslaught, right, against Elon and the company. Like there was a time in late 2018 or so where every single media outlet I could go on, like it didn't matter, like the political bent. Like it was literally every single, like CNN, you go to CNN, you go to Fox News, MSNBC, you go, you know, whatever, any outlet was negative for Elon, right? Elon was just front and center. Tesla was front and center. Everything was negative. And it was like, it was like one of those things where you had this amazing, I think I call it a generational company, where it's the company's changing the world. You know, it just has the most amazing product. They're executing with their heads down, yet the whole world is like ganging up on this company and its founder. And it's like, when you're in it, like for me, it was just so obvious. I'm like, wow, man, this is crazy. Like, there is a media campaign or something. Someone is doing something, you know, to do something against Tesla. And in some ways, it's just like that whole period of 5 or 6 years just, you know, was a huge opportunity for people to, you know, build up their positions, you know, gain conviction. I think it was great in some ways because it tested a lot of people's convictions also, you know, in the stock. A lot of
Me
things
and
happened.
you.
So you came out of it, you know, understanding the company deeper, also seeing the strengths and weaknesses of Elon, you know, as well. You know, it's like no one's perfect, you know, as well. And you get to see some of the risks. Like some people, you know, they don't in a way see much risk with Tesla. You know, but I think for people who've gone through like lots of ups and downs and lots of volatility, who have, you know, lost a lot of money as well and, you know, gained, et cetera, I think, like, at least for me personally, I have this appreciation of the risks involved in Tesla. And for any company, like, there's no company that's guaranteed. You know, there is an amount of risk. And I think it's easy to discount that risk because you're so bullish and you're rightfully bullish on the company, right? They have an amazing lead. The future seems so clear, but you know, it's oftentimes not what it always appears to be. Like that's where I get a little bit cautious when everyone in the world seems to be saying it's a done deal, you know, Tesla to $5 trillion or something. There's no risk involved. Like I completely get it, right? I'm a big bull. I see like the, you know, highest likelihood chance, 95% or higher chance that Tesla just dominates, right? But
But we could be another 5 year long winter, right? It
yeah,
could be
exactly that
stuck in
too.
this like 300 to 500 billion market cap range for another 3 or 4 years before it explodes up again, right? You don't, it could
Exactly.
happen. That's could be the Tesla's MO, you know, just to do that every 3 or 4 years. And I'm prepared for that. I'm in a good position now. I'm holding mostly stock this time and some deep in the money Leaps still. And yeah, it could happen. It might not, even though all this great deliveries and production and efficiencies are coming, they're outdoing earnings. it's possible the stock just might stay in this, like, if you talk stock price range, it might stay in, I told a bunch of people, I think it could be in the $350 to $450 range until the S&P inclusion, if that ever happens.
I think I think in a lot of ways, like, people get used to the climb. So as it jumps from 1,000 to 2,000, this is pre-split price, but people think like, oh, 3,000, 4,000, it's coming up. But it's like, oftentimes it doesn't work like that. It could work like that, but there's another angle where, there could be some macro issues. There could be different things going on. Who knows? There's a lot of things.
My take on Tesla right now, like the key thing to watch right now is the S&P inclusion. That's my take. And that's been the key take for a while. That's been the trade I've been waiting for. Not the trade, but that's what I've been waiting for, to really, like, cash out of a small piece, for some of the longer term shares I have. I've been trying to wait for that, because when that happens, and I think there's a better than 50% chance it'll happen this year, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen. Maybe the S&P just puts their foot down and is like, we're not adding Tesla for whatever reason, which would be terrible for them in the long run. And that could happen. But when S&P announces it, the amount of index funds that have to buy Tesla shares is just huge compared to the people willing to sell Tesla, in my opinion, And I think there's so many buy and hold Tesla people right now that are just like, I'm waiting until it's 5 trillion, right? And in market cap. And so all these index funds are going to have to buy it up within a month or a few weeks or whatever, they have. And I think that could, raise the price 50%, maybe 100% pretty quickly. Probably not 100, maybe, but it's going to be a big potential catalyst, in my opinion. And I'm trying to wait that out before I start selling the deep in the money covered calls. But I feel like if I sell the 800 strikes, which I think are the highest there are, I'm like afraid those are going to get called if the S&P thing happens. And like, I don't want to lose out on that. I'd rather sell the 1500 or 1200 strike calls when it's already at 800.
Yeah, exactly. I put out a video, one of my first videos, like, was in this, or at least for kind of this new launch of my channel, was December of last year, where I'm like, hey, S&P 500, we're gonna, most likely get included, next year in 2020. And I've been looking forward it to it's just so obvious, right? Tesla is like, making profits each. That's the thing with Tesla. It's like, with each new car lineup that they release, their operating expenses are not increasing that much. They're just it's pretty much stable, and so all of that margin just goes basically to operating profit, and it makes Tesla into this hugely profitable, company. A lot of people, I don't think, still they don't completely get that. But like, yeah, it's like, it was obvious a year ago. It's like, hey, Tesla's going to be very profitable, be eligible for S&P inclusion. But this kind of whole thing of the S&P 500 kind of backing off, not including, this is kind of throwing me off a little bit, because I was like, hey, before it's like seemed pretty obvious. This is like a large cap company, and it's like they're GAAP profitable, like 5 quarters in a row now. And it's like, hey, what's going on?
It's all the bears and misinformation that gets to that. All the people like you and I talk to on the street, or neighbors or friends who don't know much about it, they just have bad impressions. They think it's overvalued, the next tulips mania thing or whatever. And so the S&P committee, I guess, they're not super well informed.
Or they're getting informed from certain people or groups of people, right? That tell them,
Pressured.
like, hey, there's regulatory income that shouldn't be included, and blah, 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 all that stuff.
Absolutely. So it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely interesting stuff. This has been a great conversation. Just wanted to thank you for, being open and sharing about all your past. And I noticed, like, you're saying how, since you're transitioning from, your old company now to starting a fund yourself, now you've decided just to become more open, I guess, with your, finances, or your, your history. And I think that's extremely helpful in a lot of ways, like to actually see the numbers and to go through your thought process, et cetera. Like, personally, actually, like, I think people would benefit more if I was more transparent, actually, if I actually shared exactly what I bought, or how I bought, how much I bought, like what I had, because it gives context to some of the things that I might be sharing about or I might be struggling with. But like, you know, for me, there's like, I see that it could help people, but then also, I guess having that all out there, it also carries some downsides too, you know?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
My wife is a pretty private individual who values that privacy, you know? And
yeah,
just to have kind of everyone know, like, you know, what our net asset worth is, et cetera, all that stuff. It just kind of is a bit more complicated and more exposure than we want. But I don't know, I guess in your case, have you wrestled through those issues and are—
Absolutely.
What have you
come up with?
Yeah.
You know, there was this publication called like Hedge Fund Alert. It did their first piece on me starting the hedge fund a week ago. They published it, and I thought about going into that piece, like, am I going to put the numbers, the metrics of my, you know, how much money I'm going to start this fund, you know, all that stuff. And I just decided, like, you know, transparency is usually better in my opinion, in finance, you know, if I'm going to do a finance business, which is what I'm doing, like, if you get to a certain size, like, people know, like, you know, if you're a successful hedge fund manager, any of the successful hedge funds out there, like, you know, the person who founded it or runs it's like worth X amount of money, you know, and, you know, I hope to get there one day, you know, but if not, it's okay. I'll manage my own money and hopefully not lose it all on Tesla, but I could go back to work, worst case, you know? So I wrestled with it, and I just realized, you know, this is a finance investing media. I'm not going to publish this stuff on Facebook or, you know, public forums that's not finance related, but for finance related news or publications or whatever, I think it's probably okay. And people appreciate, I think, transparency on that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely agree. So where can people find you? You're on Twitter. Yeah. I'm actually following
Twitter.
You. What's your handle?
Yeah. It's just my full name, Emmett Peppers, kind of unique, just E-M-M-E-T, last name is Peppers, P-E-P-P-E-R-S, so Emmett Peppers, that's my Twitter handle. But more importantly, I have this firm I just founded called Good Soil Investment Management. And so goodsoilinvestment.com, if you go to that website and you want to learn more about this fund I'm setting up, I'm going to have a marketing deck in the next week or two ready. If you put your email address in, I'll add you to it. It's a 506c hedge fund, which is a little different. Most hedge funds are not a 506c hedge fund. So that means I can market it to the public, but I can only accept accredited investors, obviously. But at least I can show my performance and talk to the public about it. So I hope to post some good stuff on that website in the future. So goodsoilinvestment.com.
Okay. Goodsoilinvestment.com. And, basically only open to accredited investors. And then your fund, I'm guessing you're sharing with me privately that it's, I guess your approach is, are you going to continue to take kind of your more higher risk kind of, you know, trading approach with this fund?
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason it's credit investors, because it is pretty high risk, right? I mean, it's so far this year, it's like 50x return plus, you know, and there's a lot of risk in that, right? So I want to make clear to investors that, you know, the investment could go to zero, you know, but you could also get 50x return. I mean, I'm never going to have this type of year again. I want to make sure people know that. Like,
well, actually, you shouldn't
return.
Say never, because, yeah, I mean... You know,
it's possible.
The probabilities are, you know, you might not have, especially maybe in the near future, but who knows down the road,
who knows
what will
it's
happen.
Possible.
Yeah,
don't
exactly.
Expect it. Yeah. People shouldn't expect
yeah.
it. I have a similar investing strategy. I think you've talked about is that I look for investment opportunities that I think return 10x or more. And if I think there's a 20% chance or more of that happening, I'll make that bet. And a lot of times if it doesn't happen, it turns to zero, but that's okay. As if I get 20% of them right, I have a good return. Right. So I'm trying to make that investment opportunity set more than just Tesla, although that's my highest conviction name. And I use options and derivative exchange traded derivatives to find those investment opportunities, you know, whether it's index puts for the NASDAQ, Nikola puts, which I failed on the timing with, you know, Square option calls, which have worked out well, I think. So that's the investment strategy, is trying to get 10x or more returns on each investment decision.
Got it. And then you're putting your own money into it, right? Have you
That's
decided
right.
like a range about yet or?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now it's, I put in the 100,000 worth. The fund itself is like 5.7 million or something like that. And so that's already a nice amount, but I think I'm going to put an extra for my personal account, an extra maybe 10 to 15 or something in there. I can transfer stock, with the cost basis intact, so I don't have to pay taxes, which is nice. It would be hard to do if I taxes and then put money in, but because I can just transfer shares in and then pay taxes down the road when I sell the stocks or securities. So yeah, I'm probably putting more of my personal account into it as well. And it might not be quite as aggressive as it's been to date, but it's going to be aggressive. Yeah.
Like one thing I do like appreciate about your approach is like you're putting your own money into it, you know? Like some other people might be like, hey, I made all these gains and now I'm just gonna put them aside and start a fund with, you know, other people's money and make money off of management and not have, I guess, skin in the game. But I think, you know, your approach, putting skin in the game, especially, you know, let's say a high risk, you know, approach, at least like, you know, if things don't go well, you know, you take the biggest loss, you know, in a sense.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, my previous job was selling to hedge funds, startup hedge funds, a lot of times, and so yeah, I saw a lot of that where hedge fund managers are have a seed investor seeding them with, X million, and it's a little bit of their money, and some hedge funds start with their own money, and yeah, so I saw a variety of strategies, and most hedge funds fail and shut down within a couple of years. And so I know that's a realistic possibility here, but I want to give it my best shot.
All right. What's your do you have a long-term vision, like 5 or 10 years? What do you want to, be doing? What do you want your, let's say, your fund to be doing, or yeah, what do you envision?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so that's what's inspired me to move forward with the hedge fund is this vision I have of it being more than just making money for myself. Most hedge funds have this fee structure of 2% annual management fee, 2% of the assets is a fee, and then 20% of the performance. So that's the standard. They call it a 2 and 20 fee structure for hedge funds. So what I'm trying to do is I'm still going to charge that structure to the investors, that fee structure, but I'm putting in the prospectus of the hedge fund that half of the fees go to charity through a foundation I'm setting up, right? So, and I want to be also transparent about the foundation. Like if this takes off, I'm going to treat the foundation and the donations to charity very seriously, almost as serious or more serious than my investing decisions, and so if in 5 or 10 years, I would hope, I would love if this fund was so successful that it maybe it starts a trend and inspires a whole new breed of investment managers to do something similar, sort of like ESG investing has become a real trend. Maybe there could be like a charitable giving aspect with investment managers now that investors look for, and it'll be a trend. And capitalism has gotten not such a great name with young people lately, and the most capitalistic thing you could think of is hedge funds in a way, right? So maybe this could reverse some of that perspective a little bit.
All right, sounds good. Wish you the best, man. Thanks for
Thanks.
taking the time out to chat, and yeah, we'll talk to you later, man.
All right, thanks, Dave. Appreciate
Okay.
this a lot, and we'll stay in touch. Yeah,
All right,
sounds
see ya,
good.
Emmett. All right, bye.
All right, bye.
All right, I hope that chat was helpful. It's been a blast personally to chat with people like Emmett and others and to share these conversations with you as well. If this video has been helpful, I encourage you to like it and to consider subscribing to my channel. I've got some really interesting and fascinating interviews ahead as well. In this channel, we're looking at investment topics and the world from different angles, trying to use independent thinking to get beneath the surface of things. I'm on Twitter at HeyDave7, and we'll see you in my next video. Thanks.